have Annette Lloyd, who wrote a wonderful book about someone that she wishes were a relative of hers, but isn't, Harold Lloyd. And the name of the book is Magic in a Pair of Horn-Rimmed Glasses. Annette, are you there?
I am indeed, Dave. How are you?
We're doing okay. I have Dolly Curtis in the studio tonight also.
Great.
Hi, Annette.
How are you?
You sure you're not related to this gentleman?
I am not related, no. I was fortunate enough to fall in love with a wonderful man. His last name happened to be Lloyd. And it was just one of those serendipitous, strange things that happened. And I've had to explain it throughout my throughout my career. You know, did you marry him because his last name is Lloyd? And, you know, I wouldn't have stayed married for 10 plus years and have a beautiful 6-year-old son with him if all I wanted was the name. I could have changed that on my own.
So let me ask you something, Annette. Does he wear horn-rimmed glasses?
Believe it or not, my husband does wear the kind of the shape. I don't think they're tortoiseshell like Harold's were, but they are round, and he got them purposely because, you know, there's a level of respect that, you know, and that was one of the things that endeared me to Scott when I first met him, is the respect that he always had for Harold himself and for his character, which was so uplifting and positive.
Right.
And, you know, really inspiring to people. You know, when you actually get to know the man behind the glasses, he's even more inspiring, but he's a great study, and he's always been a tremendous source of inspiration for me. So,
well, there you go. And he's the father of your children, and has been very tolerant of your obsession with with Harold.
I always tell Scott that Harold may have been my first Mr. Lloyd, but Scott is my last and my finest.
Right, so let's talk a little bit about Harold Lloyd, because he's an interesting character, because he was a very well known and popular film star in the from the beginning of films.
His actually Lloyd's career began in 1913. He started out very, very slowly. Started out making, you know, seconds-long appearances in films for the Edison Company and Universal, made somewhat of a mark for himself with Keystone under the tutelage of Max Sennett, and he worked with Roscoe Arbuckle, he worked with Ford Sterling, worked with Charlie Murray, all the greats there.
Right, right.
But at Universal, he had befriended a fellow extra, another actor. His name was Hal Roach, and at that time, all he was a struggling extra, just like Harold was. The two of them really became fast friends, and eventually, once Roach got a bundle of money in his possession, he started his own company and recognized in Harold the hardworking and the hardworking ethic, but also the talent that Harold had. And the thing, you know, one of the things that I talk about in the book is the influence that the theater had on him in the very earliest part of his career.
Right, he was a trained. He spent his childhood as an actor.
He sure did, but it was a different kind of theatrical background than, say, you know, Buster Keaton and Roscoe Arbuckle and Charlie Chaplin had. Those guys had, you know, comedy and music hall experience. Stan Laurel as well. A very rich, comedy background.
Like
when vaudeville
or that sort of thing.
They were ready. But Harold's background, on the other hand, he actually enjoyed being the heavy. He liked roles that had a bite to them. And that's what he always said, that the villainous roles, the dramatic roles, were more appealing to him.
Funny.
Comedy, though, was something that he fell into quite naturally, and he always said that, you know, the background that he had in theater, playing all sorts of different roles, was a real benefit for him, not only as a comedian, because it wound up that he could do anything.
Right.
And when you really see, when you look at the depth of the roles that Lloyd played, you see that, you know, he could handle the dramatic roles beautifully, the comedy, the action, all of it.
What are the, in his career, when did he become more recognizable? What are some of the things people would be recognized him for today?
Well, you know, chiefly he's known for a single image, the image of him dangling from the hands of a clock, stories in the air. And that is a wonderful still from a sequence from Safety Last, which was 1923.
It's a funny name for a great name for a title.
Isn't it, though? I know. And it actually wasn't the original title of the film. The original title of that film, the working title, was $15 per. That's what they were originally going to call the film. And that refers to his weekly salary. It didn't work, and that's why they changed it. I think Safety Last was a beautiful title; just says it all.
Right. Well, a lot of the titles of the of his films were brilliant and paradoxical.
Very clever.
Yep.
They had a command of the language in those days that I wish would come back. They had a respect for the language, a command of it, and respect. They just were able to do such magical things, but they had. They had a very limited verbal, influence in these films. So that whatever they did with the words, that it was important.
Well, in the silent days, the words were on little cards.
Exactly.
So I guess that's what that's what you're referring to. It was very kind of literal.
It really was, and it was a different time, a wonderful time. It was a time in cinema that completely captured me at the age of 17, a very strange age to be drawn into this silent film. I loved it. From the minute I saw Harold Lloyd, I was drawn, and I haven't looked back yet.
I have other friends who have had similar experiences, so obviously is something about him that attracts people.
I have been very blessed over my years to be at a lot of live performances of his films in New York, in Los Angeles, in Omaha, Nebraska. And I have never seen anyone come out. I'm not kidding you. I have never seen anyone come out of a film of his and say, it was all right. Everybody who sees him wants to see more. And I remember back when I was when I wrote my first book on Harold Lloyd, which was called Harold Lloyd, A Biobibliography, and came out in 1994, those were very dark days for me. It was pre-internet. It was pre-any DVD, any VHS. It was impossible to, for me to get a true grip on his films, I had to travel out to Los Angeles to go to the film archives, to go to UCLA and USC.
Right.
I had to go to repertory houses wherever I could to see his films. It was very difficult.
So you had to work very hard for something that's very very simple today.
I still have not made back what I spent in money and time doing research on that first book, because there was so much, not only that people didn't know, but there was so much that I had to correct. And his filmography, the filmography that I have in my first book and the filmography that I have in this new book are so radically different, because I've had the opportunity, because of the focus and the digging. We call our work archaeology. We really are archaeologists in this realm.
So what kind of obviously you can write, obviously you have a passion for history. What kind of background do you have for writing a book like this?
Nothing. I don't have any formal. I majored in, believe it or not, in speech, which is kind of strange, a speech major writing about silent film. But I have a bachelor's in speech and a master's in communication, and I spent 12 years teaching public speaking on the college level. And at the age of 30, I decided I wanted to write a book. And I found out about this publisher, Greenwood Press, in Westport, Connecticut. They were actively seeking first-time authors.
Is it Max? Is that Wilk? Was it Wilk? The person who owned it, is that Max Wilkes' son? No,
it's going back. I don't okay. really have an. I remember George something okay. was the editor on the series, but this I can't remember. But all I know is that they were actively seeking first time authors, and I found I found out about them from a book club that I belonged to, and they had an ad, and I said, you know, that sounds like fun. And the first person that I thought of to write a book about was Harold Lloyd. And so I wrote to them and I said, I'd love to write a book on Harold Lloyd. And they said, well, you know, send us a sample of your writing. And I did. And they answered back with a contract. And I signed it the day after Thanksgiving in 1992, and I promptly went to bed and cried myself to sleep. I was so scared because I had never written anything professionally.
Right,
but that book was my first professional writing, and now this thing is my ninth book, and the sky's the limit of how many I'll do. Anybody can write a book. I tell people this all the time. Truly, I believe that. But you have to have a real passion and dedication and a willingness to let the subject take over your imagination for a while.
Right.
And I've done that with Lloyd. It's been, you know, it's almost 20 years now that I and I'm still not done because there's still stuff to learn about him. I'm still making discoveries. Every time I get my hands on a new interview of his or a new article, from the early days, I learn something new. There's so much. And I've said many times, I'm very hopeful that a teenager will take my book, one of them, be it this one or the Harold Lloyd Encyclopedia or whatever, and say to themselves, you know, I can improve upon this. I can do more, or maybe do, you know, a book on a film of his and really focus in on it.
Right.
That's my hope.
His career spanned went through the whole range of films from Silence to when did he made his last film?
His last active film was 1947. So it was really 1913 to 1947 with compilation films in 1962 and 66.
Which is a long time. I think most people who love films know about Max Roach or have seen a lot of the films that he worked on. The
Hal Roach.
Hal Roach. You're thinking of the jazz player.
I know.
those would be.
Those is music. That's good.
Those would be the children. What were they? The children that did the shows, the movies.
Oh,
right?
The Our Gang.
The Our Gang.
Well,
series.
Yeah, that came later. Yeah, because Our Gang premiered in 1922, and Hal Roach and Harold Lloyd began active filmmaking together in 1914.
But that's the type of films. I mean, that's the success that we're talking about in terms of films.
Oh my gosh, yes.
So
after Lloyd left, you know, Roach of course had Laurel and Hardy and
right.
Charlie Chase and Our Gang and Thelma Todd and Patsy Kelly. It could go on and on. You know, Harold Lloyd, though, at the very beginning of his career, was very, very much, he was popular. He had a series before he adopted the glasses. He had a character named Lonesome Luke.
Well, in his career, he had many characters, and some of them made him, I'd say, more than just well-known.
Well, actually, Lonesome Luke was a very, very popular character, and it was making extremely good money for Pathé, which was the distributor, and Hal Roach, the producer. And as a result, when Harold came in and said, you know, I've got an idea for a better character, I want to change, Lloyd really did not like the character of Lonesome Luke. From the beginning, he was dissatisfied with it. He didn't like the idea.
Well, how would you describe the character?
Lonesome Luke is a variation at best of the Chaplin tramp, but with variations. Like I say, his clothes were too tight. His he had two dots for a mustache. But the the character really lacked the enthusiasm and the drive.
So he's deadpan and maudlin.
I'm sorry?
Kind of deadpan and maudlin?
Very, actually. You know, I haven't seen all the films. Unfortunately, many of them are no longer extant. To my knowledge, only 14 of the 67 Lonesome Luke films survived to this day. So there are very few examples to actually study. What I have seen, though, is just a mishmash of random acts of violence, hitting, kicking, running, running to this and then running from that, and their story. But I call Lonesome Luke one of the turning points in Harold Lloyd's career for a very, very simple reason. Lonesome Luke taught Harold Lloyd what he didn't want to be, and that was a follower and a copier. He wanted to be a leader and an innovator and a creator. And that's what he did with the Glass character, which came directly after.
So the character evolved into the character with glasses, and that really put him on the map.
It was actually a total change. Lonesome Luke and the Glass character truly could not be any more different. Exactly what Harold wanted, and it was a progression in a sense, because again, Lonesome Luke convinced Harold that I can do better. I can be better than this, and I can create better films than this. And immediately, the minute that that Harold adopted the Glass character and shed Lonesome Luke, the reviews started changing totally. For instance, reviewers started talking about the Lloyd originality. They were talking about the innovative characters. They were talking about the great stories. This was something that never happened in the Lonesome Luke days.
Right, because
Luke was popular because they were fun to watch. Comedy then was very different from comedy now. What was funny then may not be funny now, and that's very true of everything. As a matter of fact, there are things that were decidedly dramatic then that are funny now, and they did. You could watch a lot of the melodramas from the teens and laugh. But in those days it was taken very seriously.
There are some that stood out because with their creativity and the uniqueness of it. One of the unique, I think that you talked about the danger films, or the films of him climbing, or
the thrill pictures. Oh my gosh,
is that one thing that stood him apart from other characters?
He actually did become known as a thrill comedian. However, he only made 5 thrill pictures out of over 200 pictures total.
But that's
how much impact these films had. The combination of suspense and tenseness with comedy was something that was not being done all that much. It was innovative. And the wonderful thing that they did in those days, and they had Los Angeles, the beautiful city of Los Angeles, as their backdrop and as their set, actually. And they made such marvelous use of landscapes and hills and terraces to give an illusion of height that actually wasn't even there. I mean, there's one film, Harold's last silent short called Never Weaken, which was released in 1921, in which they shot it on top of a terrace, and beyond the terrace was the city of Los Angeles. So what they did was they built this set on top of this terrace. And with creative camera work, it looked like they were way, way up in the air. But in actuality, they were maybe 5 feet from the ground.
Right, setting.
It was incredibly pioneering and innovative in those days. They were really, really imaginative.
Well, you think they were influential on later films that used perspective and fear, like Hitchcock did that in some of his films.
I can't imagine that they weren't. I mean, it's difficult you know, again, in one of the other turning points that I talk about is Harold's absence from the landscape, you know, in the 50s and 60s and 70s and 80s and 90s. I'll go into that if you want. But not a lot of people were talking about his influence because he wasn't around to influence a lot of later filmmakers. You know, I talk about the idea of him not allowing his films to be televised in the earliest days of television.
Well, before we get there, let's go on a little bit more about the thrill films. Because those are probably his most, have the films that have had the most impact.
They are definitely what he's chiefly remembered for.
Right.
The climbs, the putting himself in danger for comedy's sake.
Now, did he have any athletic ability to be able to do this stuff?
Tremendous amount of athletic ability. And, you know, again, I always bring this up. He would have been angry at me for doing it. But I always bring up the fact that in 1919, at the age of 26, before he made, I think he had only made one thrill picture to date at that point. August 24th, 1919, he had an accident. He was posing for publicity stills.
Yeah, yeah.
And one of the gags that they brought up, you know, props to, you know, make these pictures, make still, you know, publicity pictures. And one of them called for him to light a cigarette from a bomb. So the guy, he brought one of his prop men with him, and the guy took a bomb out and kind of, you know, said, well, you know, light the cigarette and that'll make a great picture. So Harold said, great, already lit cigarette to the wick of the bomb, but there was excessive smoke, and it was unusual for the prop bombs to have a smoky wick. As he was lowering the, you know, he had been bringing the bomb closer and closer to his head in order to, deflect the smoke, but it wasn't working. So he lowered the bomb away from his face, and the bomb blew up. It was a real bomb.
It was a good thing that he had done that.
Yeah, or else we'd be talking about somebody else right now. But what happened there was that the thumb and index finger of his right hand were severed.
So at that time, obviously it was a great tragedy for Lloyd, but was that something that was talked about in the newspapers and in the film?
I have a Los Angeles Times article on it, in which they talk about the fact that he was in he had a bomb accident. However, they don't talk about the fact that he lost the fingers, and Harold himself never ever talked about it. He mentioned it once, and I have the complete text of this in the new book, in which he wrote a letter to the Canadian offices in Quebec, actually, of Pathé, which was distributing all his films. He wrote a letter to them to ease their minds that he really felt, because at first he thought his career was over, and everybody thought his career was over. But as he started to, you know, improve, he said, you know, I think I might be able to return. So he wrote a letter to Pathé explaining about how, you know, he lost his fingers and that, you know, he's going to be having, you know, new prosthetic and how lucky he felt to be alive and all of that. But that was never, it was never released to the public. And so the public never knew about this hand injury.
Right, he covered it up. You never saw the hand or gloves.
Yeah, he wore a prosthesis, an actually revolutionary prosthesis at the time, where they made a rubber mold of his left hand, reversed it to simulate the right hand, and then cut away the part that matched what he had lost on his hand, and then covered it in a very, very thin leather glove, and then tied that onto him with a rubber band garter. And they figured it out in such a way, they figured out the sewing where the index finger was attached to the middle finger, so that when the middle finger moved, the index finger moved along with it. And the thumb remained immobile, but that's okay. But when, you know, knowing this now, you look at Safety Last, you look at the you know, climbing a building.
Which was post-bomb.
Post-bomb by 4 years.
Right.
But even before that, he never shied away from doing handwork. And I say to myself, you know, this is something that could have been exploited for publicity purposes to the nth degree. This is something that he could have made a bundle of money on, more money, on the knowledge of that.
Right.
You know, as a champion of the handicapped, which I believe he is. But he never talked about it. You know, he went through I don't know how many interviews, oral histories, televised interviews. He wrote a book. He wrote his autobiography at the age of 35. He never talked about losing the fingers. He talked about the bomb accident aplenty.
Well, was it out of fear of damaging his career?
Not in the least. He did not want the fact that he was now handicapped to take away from the films. He wanted people to go to see his films not out of curiosity, oh, I wonder what his fingers look like, you know, not out of pity or sympathy. He wanted people to go to see his films because they made him laugh. And that's what everything was about for him.
Right.
The films were paramount. The films were everything. He did not want the knowledge of his malady to deflect from the spotlight on his films.
Right.
That's it.
You can see a great many of these or parts of his films on YouTube. So if anybody wants to explore a little bit about Harold Lloyd, you could get a start, just a glimpse.
Absolutely.
Looking on YouTube. But
and a really nice, I'm very proud of the people who have, you know, posted the shorts, the, you know, the very early stuff. It's a wonderful thing. There's also a marvelous box set, the Harold Lloyd Comedy Collection, which came out, and I was very lucky to be able to work on it. Came out in 2005, and it's a marvelous set, a true gem, I believe. It's something that I would have loved to have had when I was first starting out.
Yeah, but they didn't have DVDs then.
They didn't even have DVDs then, but they didn't even have VHSs then of his films. But, you know, the fact that he's available to be viewed is such a step up now. It's such a development for you know, his visibility. He's not invisible anymore. An old friend of mine once said that Harold Lloyd is an undiscovered country. And I've run with that phrase in my head for years, because at that time, when that was said to me in 1993, it was the truth. There was, yeah, I would tell people, I'm writing a book about Harold Lloyd, and they would, 99 times out of 100, people would look at me and this confused look. Who?
Right. The other famous film of his was The Freshman.
That was his great football picture from 1925, a picture that I truly believe it is the forerunner of all sports pictures and comedy, well, comedy sports most assuredly.
Right.
But it truly was a very, very pioneering look at campus life, and it's a wonderful film because you have this kid who endeavors to go to college, maybe not necessarily to make good, but to be popular. And the steps that he takes, the things that he does to be popular, are just phenomenal. That film is not only, you know, a marvelous sports picture, a really great, you actually do see some terrific football. It's also a prime example of Harold's ability to embarrass himself for the sake of comedy. The comedy is perhaps like in no other.
Right.
You know.
So he also recreated that many, many years later
It was the beginning of his last film, The Sin of Harold Diddlebach. And that all started very, very simply put because the creator of that film, Preston Sturges, marvelous talent, was a huge fan of Lloyd and wanted to, you know, approached Lloyd and said, you know, I'd like to investigate what happened to this character after the big game. And Harold thought, my gosh, this could be terrific. It actually wound up to be a tremendous disappointment for Harold. But
Creatively?
Creatively.
Yeah.
He didn't like Harold and Sturges. Now, again, Lloyd and Sturges were two very, very strong-willed, very creative men.
Yes.
They each, though, had a different viewpoint on what should happen to the character. And as a result, they butted heads a lot, and sometimes Harold won, but sometimes Preston won. And after a while, as Harold said, my heart just went out of it. And he finished the film, but he was not proud of it. But he always said that had it been made the way he thought it should have been made, it could have been one of the greatest films he ever made.
Well, there are parts of it that I've seen that are absolutely unique and great, and those parts don't necessarily involve Lloyd; they involve other great characters.
Oh well, Edgar Kennedy, I love him, you know, and Franklin Pangborn, and
Pangborn,
they're
yes,
wonderful.
Yep.
But yeah, Harold in that film did some of the best dramatic acting that I've ever seen him do.
Right.
It was
one of the things that. The lack of success from that film is because at that time Harold was considered old fashioned, you know.
He had a problem with his character once he got into the sound era, and that problem was the depression. The problem was that Harold's character, the Glass character, was a tremendously enthusiastic and uplifting and positive character.
I mean, to an outrageous degree.
He laughed at obstacles. He thought that everything he endeavored to do, he could do through hard work and determination. Now, the problem was that the Depression hit, and that character lost its identification with millions of Americans who were, you know, they were positive, but they were out of work. And they, you know, saw their fortunes gone, and they just could not relate to the character anymore. That's the basic problem that Harold had in the 30s and into the 40s. Now, what he should have done was perhaps keep the character as the Glass character, but do something else. But his boy, yeah, you know, once you get into your 40s, you can't play the boy anymore. And when Lloyd did Diddlebach, he was 53.
He looked pretty good.
He did a wonderful job. But I think his character kind of lost its identification with its audience.
He needed to grow up a little bit.
Yeah.
Let's open up the conversation to any... you are an undeniably the most knowledgeable Harold Lloyd scholar that I've ever talked to.
Thank you so much.
If anybody has a question about Harold Lloyd or maybe something else in the era that he was a popular comedian, you can give us a call.
I got to tell you though, I actually, you know, I dedicated this new book to the fans because over the years through my haroldlloyd.us website, which has been up since 1995.
So you're a pioneer web mistress.
I thank God for that. Because that's how I met my husband.
Right.
I have been so blessed by fans writing to me and asking me questions and really inspiring me and driving me to get the answer. And, you know, whether I get a call or not tonight, the thing that I do have to say, you know, for posterity is that I have been so blessed by Harold Lloyd's fans who have been so dedicated and so... unrelenting in their support of him and by, you know, by proxy of my work. But, you know, their questions to me have been really my fodder for, you know, finding out the answer. And that becomes my research. And really, I have been so lucky that so many wonderful questions have been asked of me.
Well, you know, I wanted to ask you a question about the house, the estate, Green Acres.
Green Acres.
Now, when Lloyd became very wealthy, he built a large estate, maybe one of the largest estates of the time.
It was one of the largest. It wasn't the largest, but it was one of the, you know, it was 3,200 square feet, the house itself.
And
it was on 16 acres.
The house was an acre on an acre, right? What were some of the features of the house, estate?
I've been blessed to have been able to be in that house a number of times. Now, of course, way past. Harold Lloyd died when I was 7 years old, so I never heard his name until I was 17. So, but I've been lucky enough to be, you know, I'm good friends with the family, and I've been able to be at the house a number of times, so I can speak from firsthand experience in terms of the home itself.
Well, what strikes out the most?
It's a tough question, because I remember being so impressed by the size of the kitchen, but his living room was incredible. It was, you know, sunken. The thing about the home, he originally wanted, you know, he wanted it to be grand because he wanted it to be a testament to his success.
Because he grew up so poor.
He came from very humble, extremely humble beginning. Poor, I think you could call them poor.
Impoverished.
They were nomadic. They, you know, they lived in God knows how many towns in three states, and he had a tough childhood.
Right.
Broken home. And so when the time came, and this was not the first house he built. The first house he built was on Hoover Street in Los Angeles, and he built that, and at first his dad and his brother and he lived there. And then once he married Mildred Davis, his leading lady, her final film with him was Safety Last. She moved in, and then they built a home in the Hancock Park area of Los Angeles on Irving Boulevard.
The reason I'm interested in Green Acres, because it seems to have set a precedent.
Was a dream of his that he actually started while he was filming The Kid Brother. And he didn't want it to be a museum. He wanted it, and he considered that his home. Now, this is a home with 26 bathrooms, with, you know, it was a very unique, actually, I have thought of probably the most unique feature of the house, the dining room. The dining room is a very, very ornate, very elaborate, beautiful room. But the county line runs straight through Beverly Hills on one side, Los Angeles on the other. And so the family always told me that his wife always enjoyed eating in Beverly Hills on the one side of the table and sending Harold over to Los Angeles to eat at the other side of the table. So I always found that very, very funny. When I went into Harold's library, the desk that he had is still there, and it's a tremendous piece of wood, gorgeous. The rose gardens are still blooming, and they've actually told me that many of those plants are surviving of cuttings of Mrs. Lloyd's. So, you know, they're actual, true, still Lloyd roses. The pool isn't there anymore. The golf course isn't there anymore. The canoe run isn't there anymore.
They've been sold off.
When the home was auctioned off, sadly, in 1975, the surviving family could not maintain. The taxes alone were in six figures.
Right.
It was a tough thing to maintain, and they had originally, 1973 and 74, they had tours of the home, and that brought in a nice chunk of revenue.
Was that on the original estate as it was intact?
Exactly.
You're right.
Yeah.
Now
and then,
let's spend a few minutes to talk about the estate, which had exquisite landscape architecture.
Yes.
18 fountains? Was it 18 fountains?
Oh, at least. There were different types of fountains in different areas. There were
outrageous
cascading gardens with water features. There was a waterfall leading into a canoe run. They had I don't know how many. They had an extremely talented landscape architect come in and do the landscaping on the he chose this property because it was so beautiful, even in its raw state. When he first bought it, it had a lot of potential. It was hilly, and it was beautiful.
What year are you talking about? So what year did he develop it?
He broke ground in 1926.
Okay.
The family moved in August of 1929. So it really was about 3 years of, the interesting thing is that it was built to standards, architectural standards, so, that are still today being used. For instance, retrofitting. The house survived major earthquakes. As a matter of fact, about a month before Harold Lloyd died, there was a major earthquake in Los Angeles, the Sylmar earthquake. Magnitude, 6.8, or it was a very powerful earthquake, felt all the way to Arizona. And Harold was mortally ill at that point with cancer, and he was dying. But he got up, and he wanted to make sure that the house was okay. And one of the great his granddaughter always tells me that one of his great reliefs at that moment was that his home was intact. It had survived this earthquake. It woke him up, and he was dying, and so it was very powerful. It was a tremendous piece of architecture, of very very thick walls, it was a strong home. It was structurally strong.
Was there something what was Michael Jackson's ranch? What was that called?
Neverland.
Was there a similar kind of outrageous quality that's
not in the least?
No,
not in the least. No, I guess the most outrageous thing you might consider possibly was the golf course. It was the Safety Last golf course, with every hole had a water hazard. That's kind of outrageous, I guess. The very first thing that was built at Green Acres was the miniature thatched roof cottage
his daughter. Yeah.
They wanted her to have a safe place to play while construction bustled all the way around. And I thought that was such a sweet thing. I thought that was very, very elegant parenting. Know that your daughter is safe, and then, they can, safely go off and take care of business.
They tell you in your book, you say that the landscape architect was A.E. Hansen.
A.E. Hansen, yeah.
And the firm was from Los Angeles?
They were, yeah.
And
very well respected. As a matter of fact, they won a number of awards. The magazine that later became Architectural Digest dedicated an entire issue to Green Acres in 1930.
Oh, really?
And I'm very lucky to have that issue. And for instance, there's a staircase.
Yes,
I believe I have a picture of it in the book.
You do.
That staircase won an award because it was one of the very first to be completely self-supporting. It didn't have weight-bearing. It was completely self-supporting, and it won an award. It was the house was important to him because it reflected it represented the thing that meant the most to him, which was his career and his success.
Well, he had made his fortune then early, because this is 1924.
Well, you know, consider the fact that, you know, at this time, the movies, to go to the movies, it cost a nickel, a dime, possibly a quarter.
Listen, I remember when the movies were 25 cents, excuse me. And
right.
I'm still,
you know, at this time.
35 cents, I think it was.
Yeah, and he's making, you know, I remember reading about him being so excited when he made his first $100,000. And
well, that was a goal.
Well, that's a lot of money anyhow.
At that time, it was. But then, all of a sudden, things started happening. And he got a contract in 1921 that gave him 80% of the profits
from the
gross, you know, after the producer took his cut and the distributor took his cut, he got 80%.
Right, so
that's big money. And I calculated what he would have made in terms of, well, at that time, 2007 money. In the span of time from 1921 to 1928, just 7 years, that he made his silent features, he made the equivalent today of $2.1 billion in just 7 years.
Holy moly.
But this is from ticket prices at 5 cents, 10 cents, maybe 25. And it really says a lot. But remember also that, you know, when he was still making his one-reelers and two-reelers, he was putting out a two-reeler every month. He was very prolific in the 20s, where he was putting out two features in 22, two features in 23, 24, then one in 1925, one in 26, one in 27, one in 28, one in 29.
Right. So by the 1950s, he was retired from active filmmaking.
Oh, most assuredly. But he was not retired by any stretch.
What?
He was very active in real estate. He had tremendous real estate holdings where he would buy. He wasn't necessarily what could be considered today a home flipper, but he bought land, and he had lots and lots of land in different places. And he bought beachfront property on a street that was then known as Ocean Front. It's now known as Pacific Coast Highway. And he built a home on that. And he bought a plot of land in Palm Springs and built a home on it.
So let me ask you a question that probably has it there. Is there anything on the dark underbelly of Harold Lloyd? Is there anything scandalous or that we want to know about?
It's pretty well known that Harold, he was married to his leading lady, Mildred Davis, for 46 years. They were married until the day she died. She died in 1969. He died in 1971.
That's a long romance.
It's a long marriage. However, Harold had a number of extramarital affairs. He did, He was not faithful to his wife. That's pretty well known. He had a long-standing relationship with his leading lady, Jobina Ralston. He had relationships with many models, and he was a photographer of note. He was he specialized in stereo photography, 3D, and took pictures of Marilyn Monroe. He took pictures of Betty Page. He took beautiful shots. He took a lot of nude photographs.
Right.
But he also took landscape photos that are just incredible.
The Betty Page Harold Lloyd connection has to be a very interesting.
I had the opportunity to interview her. I didn't have that.
Well, not too many people had.
Yeah, I know. Sad to say.
So let me ask you. We've got to wrap things up in a moment or two. What? So, today, what do you think that Harold Lloyd's legacy is?
Oh, that's a tough one. No, it's not a tough one. To me, and, you know, again, you know, this book on the turning points are turning points that I, you know, I decided what the turning points were. And so I can have an opinion on what I think his legacy is, but it might not be what everybody will agree with. Personally, I think that Harold Lloyd is a role model for the way people should be, and that is that they believe in themselves, that they believe in what they can do, that they don't depend on other people to, you know, do for them, that, you know, you make good on your own.
Right.
He's a prime example of that. That's actually the way he personally believed. He was that way in his own life.
So he's personally an inspiring guy. I mean, his
to me absolutely. I mean, I look at not only the man himself but the films that he made, and there's a self belief. There's I don't want to say laughing at obstacles because that's so, it sounds trivial, but I really think that the confidence that he exudes in these films is something that we can, you know, kind of adopt in our own lives.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Believing in what we can do. I mean, I've done it.
Well, there's
writing books and, you know, all the things that I've done.
There's a blindsidedness to him, to his comedy, that is pervasive and not necessarily so. You know, like when he smashes a car, then he just goes buys another car, or he walks down the street with everything falling.
But, you know, that's actually based on a true story. When he got a really, really great paycheck during his Lonesome Luke days, and he went out and bought a car, and he promptly wrecked it on the way home.
Right.
And so he then went out and bought another car that day, and he could do it. And he had so much fun with the knowledge that he was able to do that. So that, you know, for heaven's sake, it's a grand example, but it's something that actually did happen to him.
Right.
You know, the thing is that Harold Lloyd reflects so many different types of audiences. You know, from film to film, he was a different boy. He was poor one film, then the next film he'd be rich, then the next one he'd be a coward.
Right.
Then he'd be, you know, confident. Everybody can watch a film and potentially see themselves in it. And I like that in him.
Yeah.
I like that about him, that he's so real and so adaptable and relatable.
Resilient.
Dang confident. And I like the confidence that that his characters exude, the self-confidence. And I think that more than anything is something that I think this country and people really need. I think the youth of today, they really need to see his films to understand, you know, that you can do something big. You can do things that you don't think you can do if you only try. It's one thing that I've written it to my son. He's 6 years old, but I've written this to him so many times, and to my stepdaughters as well. And that is, you know, always run with what you believe, and most of all, believe in yourself. And that's what Harold Lloyd embodies for me.
So why would you think that Harold Lloyd is popular today? I mean, most people haven't heard of him. He's really a very neglected character, and it's an interesting story. Your theory is very interesting about why he's neglected today.
Yeah. Well,
it's kind of a sad thing.
It is, and it's very simply put, he didn't allow his films to be aired in the infancy of television. And for a very good reason. He didn't want his films, A, to be interrupted for commercial breaks, and he didn't want them cut for time restraints. That's, you know, showing great respect for his pictures. However, he didn't think about the fact that while all of his contemporaries were being seen on television, he wasn't. And so as a result, all these reviewers and critics and historians are growing up with Chaplin and Keaton and Laurel and Hardy and Our Gang and Roscoe Arbuckle and, you know, whoever else, but they're not growing up with Harold Lloyd. Now, today, thank God, you know, the films are out, the DVDs are out,
right.
YouTube is here. It's just, it's a bounty. But I think what happens is people now are able to see him. And it's that's all the difference in the world. That right there is the fact that people can see him.
Well, his acclaim is growing and to where it really should be.
Well, that's true, you know, and I think that, you know, by being able to be seen, people can see for themselves why he was the most popular comic in the 20s. You know, everybody knows Chaplin, but only because that's what people were writing about him in the 50s. People were writing about him in the 60s. But no one was writing about Harold Lloyd in the 50s and 60s.
Right, right. You just got a glimpse. Right. We got to press on. I got to fold up my, you know, blankets and pants and get the heck out of here. But tell us where people can buy your... Tell us the name of the book and
so
where people can get...
The name of the book actually is a quote from his autobiography. It's called Magic in a Pair of Horn-Rimmed Glasses. And it deals with, I think I have 34 turning points in his life and career. Things that I determined were the events that shaped him and defined him and changed him for better or worse. And the book is put out by Bear Manor Media. And Bear Manor Media can be found, fittingly enough, at www.bearmanormedia.com or by going to Amazon.com.
Well, I got my copy out of the library.
Annette, this is really quite a book.
Thank you.
Looking at it while you're speaking, it's a fascinating book.
I'm very proud of it because I'm very proud of my subject. And he's really a tremendous study. And I think if people just go out and see one of his films, they'll want to see another one.
Yep. I mean, so Harold Lloyd for president.
Harold Lloyd didn't.
He would have been a darn good one.
All right, Annette, do you maintain a website for your fans?
I have maintained a website since 1995, mm-hmm. and it I can be found at haroldlloyd.us, and I'm also on Facebook, and I welcome people, you know, find me on Facebook and write to me and ask me questions. That's what I love. It's you know, the internet changed my life in many, you know, personally and professionally, many ways. But, you know, it's been so great for him because it's allowed me and others, and there are so many people who have wonderful, there are people in Nebraska who are hosting, you know, Nikki and Cohen, their names are, and they're hosting a birthday party for him, hopefully every year now. This didn't happen years ago, and I'm so pleased, and I think it's because of the internet
and
because of the, you know, the world.